Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. With Lauren Gilger in Phoenix, I'm Mark Brody. It is now time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
This has been done the right way by everybody at the state level. The city of Phoenix politicians literally went out of their way to drive rideshare out of the airport, and now they're finding that they cannot do this.
Palvert is the largest clean energy generation resource in the United States. It's a major reason that APS is 50% clean today. And so part of this plan is to say the viability of Palo Verde, major economic driver in the state, that plant's critical in this plan moving forward and us actually getting to that carbon-free future.
We've got Jim Jordan, John Ratcliffe, Mike Johnson, Mark Meadows, Debbie Lesko, Lee Zeldin, Elise Stefanik, and Doug Collins. They're going to play a strong role in kind of advising Trump's defense team and kind of where they should take things, since they kind of have a strong background on the defense and how things kind of played out even during the behind closed door hearings.
We want to honor our veterans. These are people who have served our country, who have served in war, many of them, and we want them in our state. I mean, we want to attract more of them to our state. We want to make Arizona the number one state in the country for veterans.
And joining us to talk about the start of the impeachment trial against President Trump in the U.S. Senate, the ongoing dispute between Phoenix and Uber, and more, are Doug Cole, Chief Operating Officer at High Ground, and former state lawmaker Ken Clark. Welcome to you both.
Good morning, Mark and Lauren.
So I guess we have to start with impeachment, right? I mean, and shameless plug, we'll be carrying the trial continuing this morning at 11 right here on KJZZ.
I'll turn on my transistor radio.
Yeah, Doug, I know you've been glued to it nonstop.
The drinking games are
Exactly.
What have you guys made of what's been going on so far? I mean, is it fair to say that there's really not much new that's come out?
It's rinse and repeat, you know, like you read on the back of a shampoo bottle. It's the same thing over and over. I think this all could have been compressed into about an hour, but it's going to be 3 days of an hour's worth of testimony.
Right. And that's what the Republicans are going to do, the same rinse and repeat over the weekend. I'm interested. I was obviously not in the room when they made the decision, but why did they think it was okay to do this over the weekend? Are they going to get even fewer people paying attention over the weekend?
Well, this screenplay was written back about 2 days after Trump was elected. And it's just playing out. And the end result is predetermined, and it's just an exercise at this point.
So there haven't been a ton of votes, obviously, so far. Just a few on Tuesday dealing with some of the rules, and they were generally party-line votes. And there was some maybe thought that one or two of Arizona's senators would break ranks to some degree, but Ken, it doesn't seem like that's happened.
No. I think Kyrsten Sinema should be commended for how she's handling this as opposed to McSally. McSally's out there talking about it. Sinema is taking this as an actual juror. She's not out talking about it. She's asking for more information, as I think they all should be, asking for witnesses. Of course, obviously, she's been trained legally, so I think she comes at this very professionally.
Doug, what do you think?
Well, I think that and, you know, at the end of the day, they're going to vote their party line. That's just that. This parlor game of who's going to do what and say what is what's taken the front seat in all this, because there's nothing else to talk about, because it's the same thing over and over again. So this back channel behind the scenes intrigue is the only story that's out there. And that's why we're seeing so many news organizations and talking heads like Ken and me talking about it, because that's all there is to talk about.
You guys are much more than talking heads to us.
Much more.
To
say, yeah.
Well, I think they're here. Also like, this is just a step in a process, right? I think more things are going to come out. You had Lev Parnas came out, less than 2 weeks ago he came out. There's going to be more information, more data dumps and document dumps. And I think in the end, the public is going to weigh in, and I think Trump is going to be really hurt by this.
And the public will weigh in November, because it's election year. Unlike the other impeachments that have happened, this is the one that's the only one that's had is happened in an election year.
So I was going to ask about witnesses, but let's not get into any of the more of the back and forth and how this plays out. Let's talk about the political implications then, and particularly how this might play here in Arizona as we do head into an election year. Can you say this is going to hurt Trump?
Yeah, and I think it's going to hurt McSally as well. I mean, I feel this is a Hail Mary for her. She needs her base. She's got to stick with her base. She's up against Mark Kelly, who's seemingly very popular and raising a lot of money. I mean, he is an astronaut. That's got to be good for somebody.
We heard that one or nine times last week.
Yeah,
too.
Right.
Just a few.
And I don't think she has any other way to go on this. She has to, but I think it's going to end up biting her in the end.
Well, she's got – I agree with Ken. She's got to protect her base, and she's doing that. And, you know, it's going to see how she pivots after all this is over, if she pivots. So this is going to be a very high turnout race come this fall. And, anybody that predetermines what's going to happen – I think it's way too early. That is a lifetime in politics. This is going to be, fasten your seatbelts, folks. Here we go. So she's got to stick with her base, though. That's what she's got right now, and we'll see if she pivots.
Doug, you meant that word pivot because that was a really key word, especially in the Senate race a couple of years ago. There's a lot of thought that McSally had to sort of skew to the right in the primary, and there was a lot of discussion how would she or would she pivot in the general. And the conventional wisdom was that she didn't do such a great job of it in the general election, and she lost.
Well, let's hope she's learned. Let's hope she's learned and has a different team on board at that point to help guide her through that, because she didn't do that. You are correct, in my opinion.
All right. So Sinema and McSally, obviously, listening to all of the testimony, we presume. We don't see them because the cameras are not showing the senators. But the Attorney General of Arizona, Mark Brnovich, has decided that he would like to give them some advice about how they should handle this. Doug, why would he insert himself in this?
Well, I think that isn't there a gubernatorial race coming up?
coming up to politics is involved in this somehow?
To a polling booth near you soon, as soon as this cycle's over. I think he's done a great job recently of keeping himself front and center. In fact, sometimes I think he's in the news more than the governor. It will be between the Uber and Lyft issue, I think that we're going to talk about later. This letter that he sent out, which I thought was from his political standpoint and the people he's talking to, is a well-constructed letter, by him saying that this process will weaponize the impeachment process. Is weaponizing for political purposes, very strong words. And it's a threat to separation of powers. I think that this is carefully thought out by the Attorney General. He has some very good people that work for him, very smart political operatives, and I think this is part of the opening salvo of the gubernatorial campaign.
Yeah, I think it's well thought out as a political move. I think more people are talking about why he used state letterhead for this than his opinion on it. And frankly, obviously, I disagree.
Doug helpfully brought a copy.
Has the letter right here.
He's showing it to everybody.
You can see it on the radio.
I disagree with his political opinion on it. You're supposed to believe, if you believe what he's saying, that somehow Trump was making a political policy, a foreign policy decision here. And I think you have to really tear at the fibers of credulity to believe that Trump was really just doing this for only foreign policy reasons. He actually admitted it several times. So I think there's a very good reason to bring in the impeachment clause. And I don't think that's going to be a precedent for any future maneuvers in some future president. So to me, he's just taking a side. He's using his letterhead to do it.
One other Arizona figure who's weighing in the impeachment, or will be at least in the next coming days, is Debbie Lesko, representative here, who's been named to Trump's managers in the House and the Senate trial here. What do you think the calculus is there? What is she saying about it?
The calculus is, if you show loyalty to Donald Trump, you're going to get bennies for it, right? So she was hardcore in the House. I mean, she was leading part of that group that was trying to force their way into a meeting, which half of them were allowed to be in anyway.
Down there, yeah.
Right, yeah. So she was doing the theatrics. Trump likes theatrics. And here you go, Debbie, we're going to put you on this team.
Look, I agree with Ken. The main currency with this president is loyalty. That's his number one currency. I mean, look at his press secretary here from Arizona. She started with him well before anybody took him seriously, and Stephanie Grisham has three portfolios in the White House now. That is his number one currency, his loyalty. I was out at Congresswoman Lesko's house when she was elected in the special election, and one of the first phone calls she received that night was from Donald Trump on the phone. So and her performance and actions in the House, and she sits on the Judiciary Committee.
Right.
She's being rewarded, and she's in an extremely safe district. District 8 is extremely safe, and a huge Trump supporting district. So it works. And he needed a female. There's two females in that group.
Does this potentially set her up for something down the road, especially when, presumably when at some point down the road, Republicans take back the House?
I think so. She's again, as I just said, she's in a very safe district. She can be there for life if she wants to. If she handles things correctly. So we just need to watch what happens.
All right. Certainly plenty more to come on impeachment. I suspect we'll be talking about this for a few more weeks, at least down the road.
Years.
But let's move on to something else that APS announced this week, basically saying that they will be totally using clean energy within another 30 years or so. Ken, this is an issue that you've been working on for quite a while. What do you make of what Jeff Goldner had to say?
Well, we always have to start by understanding clean energy is not renewable energy.
Right.
Clean energy can...
There is a difference.
Yes.
It involves nuclear energy.
It involves
that seems
nuclear.
To be one of the biggest differences.
Yeah. And you know, you need to give credit where credit is due. I think the big story here is that APS is moving from a position of pessimism about technology and our future, where they were putting the brakes on everything for at least the last 10 years, to one of more optimism and drive. So they should be congratulated for that. And a lot of my friends are a little upset about why you're counting nuclear. And frankly, look, you're going from 15% renewable energy standard by 2025, which is what we're on now, to 45% by 2030. That's very aggressive, and that's very good. So we should not take the eye off the ball. Because, look, APS had a huge role in dark money in this state, and they shouldn't get a pass on that. And we need to keep them pushing in the right direction, especially on distributed energy.
The new CEO, Jeff Goldner, he recognizes, in my opinion, that company needs to change, and his public perception has been way down in the cellar. And he's doing a lot to bring it back up where it needs to be. You know, technology is moving so quickly and changing so quickly that it makes the outlook on doing renewables as you know so much more on the table with battery technology. Using hydro storage water, you pump the water up when the power's cheap, and then and let it fall down. That's being considered up for the old Navajo generating station up at Lake Powell. So these ideas and technologies did not exist 10 years ago, and it's able for leaders in the energy field to look forward and implement these things, and get rid of carbon producers such as coal by 2031, which is what they're proposing.
All right, more on this in just a minute. You are listening to the Friday Newscap, joined by Ken Clark and Doug Cole. More of the conversation right ahead. You're listening to the show. You're listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody with Lauren Gilger. We continue now with our Friday Newscap conversation with Doug Cole, Chief Operating Officer at High Ground, and former state lawmaker Ken Clark. Ken, we're talking about the APS Clean Power Plan, and Doug had mentioned that the new CEO, Jeff Goldner, is really working to try to enhance the company's standing in the state and its perception. I'm wondering if there's also sort of a political calculus behind this plan in terms of maybe trying to get out in front of something that the Corporation Commission might mandate at some point.
Oh, well, yeah. And I hope the Corporation Commission mandates quite a lot here. But everyone has to remember that they've promised not to use campaign spending in the Corporation Commission, which was standard prior to what, 2014?
14.
Mm-hmm. Okay, they're not going to do that. But that doesn't mean that they're not going to use dark money. All of the rest of the state. One of the things that the APS was doing in the last 8 years, which I think was problematic, is distributing little bits of contributions out to all these little influencers, right, in small nonprofits. And then when people like me or Terry Goddard would come along and say, hey, we need your help to eliminate dark money, they go, oh, I can't, you know, APS gives me $3,000 this year. And it's that kind of thing that people are more aware of now, and they're very concerned. So APS is going to have to change that.
One final question on the clean energy plan here. Does this sort of renew the debate over nuclear? Are we going to see that play out? We already heard Sandy Barr come on the show this week and say, you know, this is great and all, but nuclear takes a lot of energy, a lot of water.
It does. And this is where I think APS likes to have their energy on their side of the meter. But in reality, they're going to have to get more aggressive on distributed generation, which doesn't take water. And as more people get electric vehicles, they're going to want to be able to charge them at their house. you're not going to be able to have people waiting in line at the local gas station for 15 minutes to charge up your car. It makes more sense at your house. I'm not dodging the question about nuclear, but that's going to what is 2030 or 2035 when that is supposed to be decommissioned or
well, they're gonna
renovated?
Have, yeah, they'll have to be renovated. I just don't see how we get away from nuclear. It's such a large part of the base load in the western United States, and we have the largest power plant, a nuclear power plant in the United States, out of Palo Verde. It's going to be a long time before we get away from nuclear.
I think we do get away from it.
At some point, yeah.
Probably by 2040, I'm thinking.
Well, we'll have you back in 2040 see if that works. I mean, we'll probably have you back before that as well.
I hope so.
All right, so there was another – we spoke about to Mark Brnovich a little earlier. He was involved in another situation. Doug's got another graphic for us. He really came prepared today.
I did. I love it. You
got to get a webcam in here to show
it's great
us.
For radio.
It is terrific for radio. The city of Phoenix has decided not to put its new rideshare fees at Sky Harbor in place pending the state Supreme Court hearing oral arguments and whether or not that fee increase is constitutional or not. Doug, I hate to throw such a broad question. What's going on?
There is so much going on here. Okay, there's so many layers. Well, first of all, the voters passed Proposition 126 in the last election, which deals with cities and local governments.
No new taxes or fees.
No, raising fees. It was sold that you can't, you know, we don't want to tax our barber, our hairdresser, our dry cleaner. That's what it was sold at, but now it's being applied. Then we have the famous Senate Bill 1487, which was passed a number of years ago, that allows any member of the legislature to petition the attorney general to say, hey, look, that local government's doing something bad. You need to look at it. And if they are, you need to take their state shared revenues. So both of those things are going on here. The attorney general is, again, as we discussed earlier, being very adroit and using this issue and keeping himself in the media. But let's go back to what the facts are. The city of Phoenix Airport, Sky Harbor, is the number one rated airport by the Wall Street Journal just a few months ago in the country. It is a jewel. It is part of our economic development in this city. No one that operates, no private business that operates out there does it for free. Nobody, from the gift shops to the airlines to the freight haulers, no one operates there for free. It receives no tax revenue. Okay, the proposed fee that Phoenix is offering to drop off and pick up is right in line with what Los Angeles is doing, what San Diego is doing, what Minneapolis is doing, and way below the Chicago airports, Dallas, and San Francisco. Okay, it's market rate, and they're using a public resource to make money.
Yep. And yet, at the same time, this seems like it would, at least on its face, run afoul of Prop 126, right? This is, you could argue, a service and a raised fee on it.
One could argue that, and Goldwater Institute likes to argue that. But that I don't think it does because, as Doug said, this is a functioning facility that is mandated by the federal government to operate on its own, right? It can't take general fund money. So it is doing that. It's doing what it's supposed to do. The airlines are in favor of this because they're saying, hey, look, we have to pay these fees. And frankly, I just don't get it at all because a rising tide lifts all boats. If you have safer parking, drop off and pick up, which is part of this plan for rideshare, you've got people being able to pay a lower fee by going to the 44th Street station so they can take the light rail, right? You're going to get more people going to the airport, and that's going to help rideshare as well.
Here's my question with all of this, and I think this keeps coming up as this goes on, and maybe I'm just naive, but as you mentioned, Doug, like this is not any different than any other airport in the country does this, right? How did this become a political issue here? Where did this spark?
Well, because rideshare, if you remember, along with Airbnb and VRBO, that has been really the flavor of the last 5 years at the legislature. It's, you know, the gig economy, you know, the shared economy, and we can't do anything to hinder that. But there are consequences for things. Nobody gets a free ride, pardon the pun here, okay? And this is not out of line. We are not at the top. These proposed fees are not at the top, and they're not at the bottom. They're dead center with our peer airports here in this part of the United States. So we can argue all night legally about whether the city of Phoenix and, you know, that it's structured exactly right. But we'll find that out through the Supreme Court process. And, you know, they always can go back and revisit it. But I use Uber and Lyft myself to the airport, and I'm happy to pay these fees.
Can I jump on something? So Doug and I are on different sides of the aisle here. But I think we both believe that you have to pay for infrastructure. And that was the frustrating thing about Prop 126. I'm a realtor, but I absolutely oppose that because it's the entire mentality behind it is, well, you know, don't make me pay for something that benefits everybody. And that's – Arizona wasn't built on that mentality, and we're not going to be able to survive on that mentality. And this is more of the same.
Well, how do you guys think this ultimately plays out? I mean, Phoenix, if it's told that this fee is unconstitutional, it basically has to undo it or lose a big chunk of money.
Well, Mark, I think it's if indeed they are told that this – the way they did it this time around was unconstitutional – then they can go back and hopefully the Supreme Court ruling is instructive on what's wrong, and then they can go back and cure it.
Fix it.
These 1487 complaints, you know, the first one that was made after the law was passed was up in Snowflake on how they did the business fee with the big marijuana grow facility up there for Copper State Farms. And they basically just said you did it wrong and gave instruction on how to cure it. Then the town council in Snowflake within a week turned around and did it correctly, and everything's fine.
All right. Well, our arguments, I think, are scheduled for March or April.
March.
So we'll get a sense, hopefully sometime later this year about that. So a few minutes left, and I want to talk sort of carefully about a story that came out in the news this week dealing with an alleged inappropriate relationship between a state lawmaker and a lobbyist. And without getting into the details of the salacious nature of it, I'm really curious about how the relationship is supposed to work between a policymaker and a lobbyist. And fortunately, we have one of each in the room here. So, Doug, from your perspective, I mean, you've been at this for a while. You have relationships with people. You know a lot of lawmakers and have known them for quite some time. From your perspective, how do you sort of keep it on the straight and narrow?
Well, as a lobbyist, your reputation is everything. And your relationships, that's what you do. That's your calling card, and that's how you ply your trade. So I've always operated, and our firm operates, that it's kept on the – everything is upfront, transparent. And, you know, if it – you know, it's the old – like I think Justice Potter said, you know, you know it when you see it.
Talking about obscenity.
Obscenity, when he was talking about obscenity. So that's how we operate. You know, unfortunately, in these political positions, you know, the people spend a lot of time together. And it can be very intense in our compressed legislative sessions. And rural lawmakers are here in town. They're looking, you know, they don't go home to their families. They're looking, you know, it's easy for them to go out to dinner and such. And so relationships are built, but you got to draw the line. You got to separate, because at the end of the day, it hurts families, it hurts clients, and it hurts the reputation of our democracy.
Absolutely. I think there's a lot of pressure on lobbyists to go out for that drink after whatever long day. And I think legislators need to be aware of that. They need to be aware of that power and difference. And frankly, I'm a little disappointed with Rusty Bowers. He seems to be just kind of delaying a very tough conversation he needs to have with Cook and his caucus. His caucus, year after year in the last few years, has not been looking good in this kind of scandal department. I think that they need to get a handle on that.
Along those lines, real quickly, I mean, the House still doesn't have a code of ethics, an issue that's come up, as you mentioned, over and over again. Does this push in that direction?
I would hope so. But that takes leadership, right? It takes Rusty Bowers to be able to stand up to his caucus.
I think we will see one shortly.
That would be nice.
And how do you put into policy how people interact? Like, you can't, to some extent, like, you can't legislate everything that people
Look,
do, right?
Mark, every major corporation in this country has a code of ethics and a governance manual. That's what's required in today's society. And especially after the Me Too movement and a lot of recent things, it can be done successfully. And again, in order to protect our democracy, we need to do this. We need to do this.
Ken, would it be easy, do you think, to get lawmakers to follow something like that?
It's never easy at first, but you have to stand up, stand by it. Like, the leadership has to say, this is a thing, you're going to do this, or you're going to lose your chairmanship, you're going to lose that bill that you really want to see through. They just need to stand up to it.
But even if they have the manual, unfortunately, you're dealing with humans, mm-hmm. and the human experience, it's still going to happen, but at least there is a guidelines and a roadmap and something to point to.
And presumably consequences for people who don't follow
it.
All right. We'll have to leave the conversation there. That is Doug Cole, Chief Operating Officer at High Ground, former state lawmaker Ken Clark. Guys, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.